Welcome to Unfortunately Required Reading, where I'm going to be very, very, very drunk by the end of this episode.
Yeah, would you like to tell the listeners what you just put in your glass?
So, okay, we're reading Breakfast at Tiffany's, so I found this recipe for a Tiffany Blue Sparkler. The original recipe is Prosecco and Hypnotic. Tori did great. She got Hypnotic. I don't know what's in Hypnotic. I don't know what that is.
So it's vodka, fruit flavors, and a little bit of cognac. And the truth is, Mark likes Hypnotic, which is the only reason we have it in the house.
Valid. Every experience I've had with Hypnotic has been like at an ad agency event, ergo not the best.
Oh. That tracks. It's very pretty looking, and it yes. definitely adds something to an otherwise bland cocktail, but it's yes. not necessarily the best tasting liqueur.
Yes. So I cheated and got Smirnoff Blue Raspberry Lemonade because it's like, it's also blue. I put 2 in my glass of Prosecco to compensate because it's very light blue. Only to find out that each 50 milliliter bottle is 30% alcohol by volume.
So Amanda's going to be feeling pretty great.
Hey.
The resurgence of the Lush at the 14-minute mark.
Oh my gosh. I have water next to me, and I have nowhere else to go. So, oh man, when I order pasta after this, it's going to be so fucking good. But yeah, welcome to Pride. You know, for all the hell that's been going on, we had a pretty nice week. Pat Robertson died. Trump was indicted. Trump's going to be indicted. Like, there's still a lot of trash going on, but I'm not mad at the recent developments.
People are starting to realize that IBLP is a cult.
Right. Like, there's good stuff happening. I saw on the Catholic Answers TikTok that someone was talking about being gay. And it was, it's not about your attraction that's bad. It's you are denying a woman femininity by not having sex with her. So they somehow made it sexist and homophobic. I didn't think that was possible. I didn't think that patriarchy could double down so hard.
And make the cognitive dissonance is real. I've been watching all those documentaries on Hillsong, and they were talking about how when somebody would come forward as gay, they would jokingly, I put it in huge air quotes, tell female staffers that they should have sex with them and that they would be forgiven in the eyes of God for converting him back to his masculinity. I shit you not.
But yeah, I commented because I was being a troll, and I said, you know, I guess my problem is that I started kissing girls and I kept kissing girls. And eventually someone said, you're a hedonist, which congrats, you found me. Congrats. You found me. Here I am. I've been here all along. You're a hedonist. Yes, I am. Oh, and someone said that gender is not fluid. So of course, you know, I'm not gender fluid anymore. This one person on Catholic Answers TikTok said that gender is not fluid.
I found the most random wholesome post online, and it was, even if you're pretty sure you're straight, sometimes you should just check in on your gender from time to time. And this like cis dude is like, yep, nope, still boring.
Yeah.
I'm like, okay, good. But it was so wholesome because he was like very supportive of his friends and stuff. He's like, nah, I'm still boring. Y'all do you.
Oh, I got to tell the story of the time that I was colonized at Cracker Barrel to a friend.
Oh, yeah. So that's the other big news story that came down. Yeah. Is Cracker Barrel has fallen, according to this online religious Texas group. Because suddenly they're vocalizing being supportive of Pride, which is totally a marketing thing because they're still racist as fuck.
Okay, so that's what it was talking about. I don't think Cracker Barrel itself is racist, but its level of white nostalgia very much attracts racists to be there. I don't think Cracker Barrel as an institution is racist. I think the brand of white nostalgia they've commified, commodified, is very much attractive to a type of racist, if that makes sense.
It does. Like I also support people going in and replacing their pictures with their own. I think that's hilarious.
I fully support that. But like, I don't think as an institution they're racist. I mean, everything with rainbow marketing is always going to feel inherently like a scam because that's what capitalism does. It cheapens everything. And especially this late in the game, it feels particularly inauthentic. They've had years to enter this race, essentially, and they're choosing now. So it's never going to feel like genuine allyship in the same way that Hot Topic doesn't feel like genuine allyship, in the same way that the identity tequila I saw leaving Total Wine doesn't feel like genuine allyship.
I just remember when you used to go into Hot Topic and you thought you were entering the mouth of hell, and like, it was grungy and dark and creepy. And then they started selling pre-made punk clothes. Yes. And maybe this had been something that had always been there, but that was like when you're 16, that's like goth mecca or was. And now it's so clean and just like, my mom's not afraid to go in that store anymore.
Yeah, actually, that was one of the reasons I got hired when I was 16, was that I wasn't covered in piercings and tattoos and people felt safe approaching me. On my first day of Hot Topic, I was opening up shipment, and inside were a bunch of bras and panties, CDs, and a bunch of Happy Bunny t-shirts that said all you conformists are exactly the same. And I've never forgotten that. All you nonconformists are exactly the same. None of you are doing anything.
I always want to be like, Happy Bunny was the early form of meme culture before the internet really took off.
Yes, back in those days, we expressed our feelings on little aluminum pins, like military badges, even though none of us had ever seen combat. Are you ready to talk about Breakfast at Tiffany's?
I actually am. I come in confessing that I do really enjoy this book. I like the movie better. The movie is a completely different entity. I need to throw that out there. And a lot of that had to do with the Hollywood codes and telling George Axelrod he had to tone it down. Mm-hmm. But go for it.
I come in honestly not really caring much about Truman Capote. And not really liking this book, but I hate to sidebar, Tor. I'm going to send you a message on Facebook. Please talk me out of buying this crab lamp.
You said crab and lamp. Why would I? Oh, it's from the Cracker Barrel?
Yeah.
Okay, but that's fucking amazing.
Tori, I need the crab lamp, right?
I am putting that in our show notes so people can see the crab lamp.
It's a good crab lamp. It's phenomenal.
That like speaks to your cancer soul, dude.
I really want to build a menstruation crustacean station.
Do it.
But I'm also building a demon core lamp.
How is that going, by the way?
Pretty great. I love the Demon Core. Do you want a short story long?
Yes. So this one is actually short because the book is incredibly short. It's a novella. It's not a novel. So we have an unnamed narrator living in a brownstone on the Upper East Side of New York City. And when the book begins, he's sitting at a bar talking to his friend, who's a bartender, about what they think happened to Holly Golightly, a charming call girl that disappeared after some scandal. There's a theory that she may have ended up in Africa, and there's a carving that someone found, and they believe that it's a carving of her. Interestingly enough, this is based on a real Holly Golightly is not necessarily based on a real person, which we'll talk about later, because there's way too many things, too many factors to that. But the carving story was actually true about an actress that disappeared at some point in time. So Truman likes to take what he finds and throw it all together. So the narrator reflects on meeting Holly Golightly after she runs afoul of their upstairs neighbor, who is a Japanese man who may or may not want to take scandalous photos of her. She rings the narrator's bell at all hours of the night to get in because she always loses her key. Holly is 19, charming and beautiful, and has an insanely precarious life involving socializing with wealthy men. That's how she makes her rent. That's how she gets through the day. She and the narrator become fast friends, but she's very flighty and she's not a great friend. Also, he is gay, and that is written not specifically, but it is implied.
We'll talk about that.
Yeah. Holly regularly goes to Sing Sing prison to meet with a man named Sally Tomato, who's a gangster, and she gives him the weather report. It's clearly coded messages so he can continue to run his business from the inside, but she acts like it's nothing at all, and she's just saying words, and then she gets money after from his lawyer. She gets paid pretty good to do this, so in between her gigs and partying, that's really how she makes a lot of her money. She decides she's going to try and marry Rusty Trawler, a rich man, but he's not really all that awesome. She ends up moving in another girl into her apartment named Meg Wildwood, which is interesting because at one point in time, her and Meg are at each other's throats for random shit, and all of a sudden it's like, we live together now. Meg is dating a man named Jose, who's a Brazilian politician. Meg ends up running off with Rusty Trawler, and they get married. Holly and Jose move in together, but he fears scandal if they get caught because he's a wealthy Brazilian man and he wants to remain in politics. Holly decides that she and Jose are going to run off to Brazil together. But even after she stopped working for Sally Tomato, she ends up being arrested for it and basically escapes. Jose runs off on her after leaving her pregnant. And there is a whole thing about a miscarriage. She ends up taking her plane ticket, which he hasn't cashed in, and she heads off to Brazil and leaves a series of small notes to the narrator, who she refers to as Fred based off of her brother. This leaves out a lot of other details, including her being a 15-year-old bride of a much older Texan man who basically keeps her to take care of the house and his children, who are almost older than her, in exchange for him not telling on her brother, who is gay, before he goes off to the military. A lot of this book it's a bunch of little vignettes and things thrown together. One of the biggest difficulties they had in turning this into a movie eventually was trying to find a storyline. When you hear people describe Breakfast at Tiffany's, usually the book, they're usually like, so there's this woman named Holly Golightly, and this is about her adventures and the weird shit she does and how her friendship with her neighbor. Because there's so many random little things and they all kind of tie into each other, but there's not really a solid storyline.
Correct. And it's definitely, I think framing it as a series of interesting little vignettes is the best way to put it. Because, yeah, I can only imagine how difficult it must have been to find a necessary through line, which is why the movie and the novel are so different, because there's not really much of a Hollywood three-act structure that you can pull from a text as writ.
Yes, it was also one of those things where somebody read this when it was still in galleys, and said, I want the rights to this because someday this could be something. And paid Truman Capote $65,000 and said, I need the rights. Truman Capote didn't give a shit. He wanted to go off to Europe with his boyfriend. Like a lot of people who were of not heterosexual nature. Europe was not necessarily 100% safe, but it was a lot safer than the United States.
Yeah, I think that's a very, very... chill way to put it, because I think especially during this time when we talk about history and stuff, sometimes people will either over glamorize the experience of going overseas or like under glamorize it. So that's a very like fair and balanced way to put it, that like it was different, it was better, but marginally so. We're not gonna sit here and make it sound like anyone who was living a less than straight life was having a grand old time anywhere.
for example, like Josephine Baker had a better reception in France and Germany mm-hmm. than she did in the United States. Mm-hmm. But it still wasn't everybody going, Josephine Baker, yay, you're Black and
exactly.
Hamilton, yay, or and queer. It was, well, this is an interesting, the phrasing that they used toward Josephine Baker is just fucking atrocious. But
yeah,
suffice it to say, they thought of it as exotic.
Yeah, it was an interesting lifestyle she chose that was definitely worded in a not the kindest of ways back in those days, but nothing was. I mean, I say we have the luxury of looking at this in better times, better in some places. Whomst yeah. places, I'm not always sure.
You're less likely to get fired from your job for being gay, like the Lavender Scare, but there's still a possibility.
There is still a not zero possibility.
Your neighbors in Texas still might scrape off the rainbow flag that you have on the side of your drive.
My current favorite are the pissing matches that neighbors are getting into over that kind of stuff where it's like, oh, I can go gayer. It's like, yes, fantastic.
I just find it really funny when people like walk onto your property and try to deface things. It happens a lot where I am. It's why one of the reasons we don't decorate the front yard for holidays anymore mm-hmm. is because people just come and either steal shit or break shit. Mm-hmm. And we're not in the super bad neighborhood. It's just what happens in San Antonio, and probably not in like Los Olmos or freaking like more northern areas, but
yeah,
we don't have that kind of money. So,
I mean, I would argue that some of the people out there don't have that kind of money either. I would argue that they also don't have that kind of money, but you know. All right.
So there is a lot to unpack in this.
honestly, more than I think either of us were probably expecting.
Right. Because it is so short.
It's really short.
So a lot of the book is based on cafe culture and mm-hmm. parties and the lifestyle that Truman Capote was living. Yes. He had a group of women that he hung out with that he called the Swans. We'll go into mm-hmm. that a little bit more. But a lot of the traits of Holly Golightly are based off of real people, including himself. Mm-hmm. It's not all one person. There are a lot of aspects of this that can be tied back into, I think her name is Babe Paley, who is mm-hmm. or was married to the guy who they named the Paley Center after her in Los Angeles, big broadcast guy. She basically mm-hmm. spent a lot of her life tending to her husband. That was her whole job. Her husband would take her away from their kids. He would require her to do all sorts of things that mm-hmm. was just taking care of him. Mm-hmm. Now, during the day, she had very little to do, and she would go out drinking with Truman Capote. But if her husband snapped his fingers, she had to go back. And she was not yeah. thrilled about it. He also hung out with, like, Gloria Vanderbilt, which is mm-hmm. hilarious now to be like, Anderson Cooper's mom, but Gloria Vanderbilt is an entity in her own right.
Yeah, it's always in the whole like Nepa baby conversation. I feel like not enough people talk about Anderson Cooper and his mom.
Very supportive mother, though.
Oh, yeah. Great, great human being. Just saying.
There are a lot of aspects of Truman's own experiences in Holly Golightly as well.
Mm-hmm. Frankly, too much.
Yes. I mean, it's. If you need one person to base Holly Golightly on, it's him.
Mm-hmm.
I hate to tell you this for all of you out there, like, but I've always wanted the Audrey Hepburn silhouette and the Givenchy outfit. And yeah, there's a lot to that.
Right.
Friendship is a huge thing in this book. What's interesting is when they adapted it into the movie for mm-hmm. shits and giggles and to be able to get through a lot of the coding, they made the narrator into a man who yes. was very straight and yes. lived a similar lifestyle to Holly. In the book, he's very clearly coded as gay. Yes. He is thrilled the first time he ever gets something published, even though he's not getting paid for it. Mm-hmm. Their friendship is a lot of him observing Holly and Holly disappearing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's definitely a lot of very, very interesting coding that goes on. And this is my favorite kind of book, the kind that thinks it's very subtle. And it isn't. It's very, very apparent to anyone who's looking at this for longer than a half second. But cafe culture has always been, you know, part and parcel to the queer experience. It's where we gather. It's where we make plans. It's where we discuss. It also goes hand in hand with a lot of the experience of sex workers, which is where the two often commingle. And, you know, we see it now in the modern iteration of it, which is brunch, where brunch is a 3 to 4 hour experience and cultural exchange that usually ends with someone doing poppers behind a dumpster and going for a dick appointment at 1:30.
Have you ever been to drag brunch at a gay bar? It is.
I have not.
An experience, and I 100% support your local drag queens. In California, the bar no longer exists, so I don't feel like I'm telling tales out of school. I have never been more drunk at a brunch experience in my life. Those very, very sweet waiter boys were not messing around. Your glass started to get even like a third of the way down. They're like, do you want more? Or do you want to put juice in? I'm like, I don't want to put juice in. They're like, okay. And would walk away. Just impeccable service. You basically have to be wheeled away. When we would go, we would always make sure that somebody... We were going to have a D&D from the outside. D&D, mm-hmm. Sorry. We're going to have a designated driver from the outside. Because there was always the chance one of us would be like, let me just sip your red velvet martini. For people who went to drag brunch in Santa Ana, California, you probably know where I'm talking about. If you don't,
yes.
They're gone. So unfortunately, you can't find them anymore. But it was amazing. And it was a very welcoming environment. It was very mm-hmm. safe. It was very supportive. Mm-hmm. I always felt kind of weird at the beginning, but it was catered in a way that they wanted a lot of cis allies to come in, because then there was less of a chance of them getting raided. Which sounds like it's not something that happens in modern times, but unfortunately it still does.
It does.
To the extent of, well, not in most cases, not the extent of things like Stonewall.
It depends on where you are. It also usually depends on the type of drag that's being done. We don't have the time or the energy to talk about that kind of stuff, because in the last episode, when we even hinted at it, Tori started crying, and we need a complete
episode. Well, I started crying because of the lack of transgender rights, to be fair.
True.
Which is still valid. There are many different types of drag. It's not just female impersonation. It's not just, you know, somebody dresses up like Selena or Dolly Parton. There's a lot to it. There's a awesome book that's out on the market right now called The Little Book of Drag. It's short. It's cute. It's colorful. It's actually written by a professional drag queen from San Francisco. Highly recommend it. If your only experience with drag has been Drag Race, I highly recommend you read books written by drag queens from the 70s and 80s. There's a lot more to the culture, the history, and the performance than you think.
I say yes, but softly. I've kind of entered my FUBU era, which, if you aren't familiar with that acronym, it's For Us, By Us, where I think one of the biggest issues that Drag Race has had recently is gaining mainstream popularity. When Drag Race was a show that was watched primarily just by queer people, and particularly queer people of color, there were more frank conversations about transphobia and racism. There were more frank conversations about the fact that Stonewall was a riot and started with a brick. There were more conversations about supporting your local drag queens. And now, because a lot of these queens have to be role models and media stars rather than just fucking drag queens, they don't have those same conversations anymore because it has to appear.
That's my point entirely. The early seasons are very different from what's on now.
Exactly. So, and I say that to almost like, I don't know if the people who watch Drag Race now know or frankly even care. And I say that with love, as much love as I can. I can imagine, you know, I remember watching some of the promos for DragCon, and it's like a bunch of children's like, I love drag queens. And it's like, you don't know why we do this. You don't care. You just see someone who's wearing too much makeup. And yeah, I'm entering like this weird like in-group, out-group phase where it's like, we need to keep more things in because when we let people have it, it goes wrong. When we let other people in, horrible things happen. We need more bricks.
And that's the difficulty, because this is a thing in most cultures, in almost every grouping you can think of. There's something that's small and protected, and it's something that is passed down from either generation to generation. It's a story. It is a ritual. It is a something that is core to the group that goes mainstream in pop culture. And then all of a sudden it's like everywhere. And it's not about the culture, and it's not about the study, and it's not about the ritual and the family. It's about how much money can we exploit out of this? Right. And that's what capitalism does, baby.
Yeah. And it's confirmed. It's the worst. I remember watching early seasons of Drag Race and getting more of the references, understanding more about it, and, you know, really enjoying all of those things and learning things that I didn't previously know about being queer and such. And now it's just, oh man, everyone just wants to be on TikTok. And I like TikTok, but not that much. But cafe culture has always been central to the queer experience, and it always has been central to really any resistance group. You can make that argument for people who wanted to start the revolution in France, thinkers, philosophers, artists, poets. Everyone has centered in these cafes. You can take it all the way back to the ancient times where you gather in temples and such like that. But having a gathering place that is a safe space, a safe spot, has always mattered. And it's why so many of the attacks on being trans and being a drag queen and being gender nonconforming are so scary. Also, the fact that no one's thought any of them through. My favorite part being, there's a convention in Florida, an anime convention in Florida, that basically can no longer allow cosplay because of the way their bill is written. And it's horrible and awful, but it's going to get worse before it gets better. Do you want to talk about the power of friendship?
So I was talking about it a little bit. It's really the only reason, one of the only reasons that our characters kind of get through some of the shit they get through. Mm-hmm. What's interesting about Holly is she is very protective of the inner parts of herself, and for good reason. She is so shocked when Doc comes back and talks to her friend and tells her things about her. The narrator doesn't really know her whole story. He's very intrigued by Holly, but he doesn't know everything that goes into her or makes Holly Holly. To the point where at one point in time, they're supposed to meet up for drinks. It's getting really late. He goes up to her apartment, and a completely random guy he's never met before answers the door. And it turns out that this is her agent from Hollywood. And that at some point in time, right after she left Doc, she was going to go into movies. And then she decided it was too much pressure, and she actually ran away to New York so she wouldn't have to go for a screen test, because she's like, that's not who I am. She perpetually likes to say things like, I hate phonies, I hate certain things. But then she embraces that culture, and she embraces that attitude, because it's a survival technique.
Yeah.
I mean, the same way that,
No, it's a survival technique for countless people. I mean, it's almost impossible to exist in this world without having to bow at least a little bit to that sort of thing.
And this also ties into the concept of scandals for the wealthy versus scandals for the poor, which mm-hmm. is a big thing that goes through this. As a member of the poorer community, she has to be a chameleon. She cannot, or as they say in the show that you don't like, be a goldfish. So Ted Lasso. So there's a whole thing.
Okay, hold on. I don't dislike Ted Lasso. I think it's another one of those shows that a certain type of man watches and feels very smart and very deep for having watched it. I think the show is perfectly serviceable. I'm commenting on there is a significant group of viewers that tend to think that they are these refined, cultured people having watched a show on Apple Television.
I highly enjoyed it because I felt it was positive at a time where we really needed the positivity. Plus,
and I fully respect UK, that.
So, and I love the culture conflict because I've lived in the UK and it's real. It's fucking real. Sorry, I completely forgot where we were. So Holly can go through 100 different scandals in a day.
Mm-hmm.
She moves on. She moves past it. Acts like it doesn't matter. She does things that are clearly illegal multiple times. However, the wealthy people and the wealthy friends around her cannot be seen to be doing the same thing. Mm-hmm. So they'll still do things that are illegal. They'll still do things that they try to get away from. But she ends up acting as the scapegoat a lot of the time, which is one of the reasons she's so protective of herself. She gets out before it becomes an issue, except in the case of Sally Tomato.
Right. And I mean, we see that now with modern celebrity culture that, you know, once you reach a certain tax bracket, everything you do is scrutinized. And to a certain extent, there's a part of me that thinks that that's inherently negative to let these people do things. But I think also with a certain amount of money, I don't want to say that you have a moral superiority that you need to maintain, but certainly there are different factors that come into play when you do. I was just talking about this. It was, I think, Robert De Niro, who just had a child with a woman who's at least 20 years his junior, possibly more. And regardless of how many times they may say they love each other, there is always going to be an imbalance there. Now, if that happened to my neighbor down the way, yeah, that's sketch. But I'm sure that that person isn't so much with them for their money. And if so, it's a Dorothea Puente scenario where it's really not that much. And that's just a bad person to begin with.
We see a lot of that in culture too. And that's where you get kind of the concept of white trash, which is, and it is in every grouping. There is the people with the money and the people who don't have the money. Yes. So you will see, oh, whatever. She lives in a trailer. That sounds like normal behavior. That's fine. Oh, so there was this big joke of online for a while. It was, what looks classy if you have money, but trashy if you're poor, speaking more than one language, day drinking, that kind of stuff. and we see a lot of this with Jose, and he's very much a Brazilian politician. He's in the United States for cultural exchange. He is happy to use Holly in every way possible until she becomes inconvenient.
Right. And, you know, you talked about that with white trash, and it's something that also a lot of people of color face as well. I was just talking to someone about this, and there's this, someone was musing on why especially Black women are so tired, and it's, we have to wear so many hats in one day. Every single day, I have to be a doctor, a psychologist, a businesswoman, a cleaner. I have to wear so many hats in one day just to navigate white society and to exist and hopefully not end up murdered by the end of the day. And it's exhausting. I also see a lot of that with the gentrification of what is essentially poverty culture on things like TikTok and Instagram, where you have hashtag van life. I know if I ever called my family and said, I'm living in a van, they'd be worried about me. That's not a cool fad. It's, oh shit, Amanda's homeless. But we judge a person who is experiencing houselessness, who isn't housed and can't afford it, can't afford thousands of dollars to spend on a souped up van. And we certainly don't use any of that to address all of the reasons that so many people can't afford housing.
We also tend to highlight mental illness in the wealthy as a positive thing versus poverty. For example, the biggest case I can think of is Jon Krakauer's book, Into the Wild. A rich kid goes to Alaska and lives in a school bus and eventually dies. But for tons of people, he's considered to be a hero because he left behind his corporate life and went into the wilds, live off the land. The man fucking died.
Was he mentally ill?
Huh?
Was he mentally ill?
Yes. He had a lot of mental illness issues that were not treated. And this is... I shouldn't be going off onto this, but there's a whole... I'm reading a book right now about missing persons in our national parks. Terrifying, you guys, because they don't actually keep track of the numbers of the people who disappear. It's a whole thing. And just who gets looked for and who doesn't get looked for. It's creepy. It's really, really scary.
I messaged you that one night. I'd fallen down that rabbit hole of missing individuals that were unknown. They didn't have names or identifications. And I remember messaging you saying, I'm deeply disturbed by how many of these people look like me.
Exactly.
And that was something that I wasn't prepared for. Not just that it's tragic that so many of these people, you know, aren't allowed rest, don't have a name, aren't known, but how many of these people look like they could be me, my mom, my dad, my grandmother. So we have a huge issue with that just by nature. We don't handle celebrity well. Arguably, since celebrity was invented, we've never handled it well, but especially now we handle it even worse. I think a lot of it is stemmed in good reason. There's a lot about our modern celebrity industrial complex that we should be questioning and that we should ask questions about. If just the Me Too movement is to be taken with any level of seriousness, this needs to be examined a great deal, a lot. But I think we take that in too many directions that are not necessary. And there's always a lot of homophobia. There's always a lot of sexism that's rooted in it. There's a non-insignificant amount of racism that is involved in it. I was just talking to Amber about this with Jonathan Majors and Ezra Miller. And Ezra Miller still gets to be in a very, very big fancy movie, even though they are a confirmed criminal. Jonathan Majors, while I am not diminishing the claims against him, essentially imploded his career in 48 hours. Mm-hmm. Now, I'm by no means, again, trying to say that one is better or worse than the other. Both are criminals and both should be treated equally. And objectively, they have not been.
They definitely have not been. We're still getting a Flash movie.
And everyone actually says it's quite mediocre, except for all the parts that aren't Ezra Miller. Thank God. I hope it tanks.
So one of the really interesting things in this book, too, is just the transient nature of a lot of the characters. Mm-hmm. When they go to make permanent decisions, things don't go well. Meg mm-hmm. Wildwood and Rusty Trawler end up divorced, and it's brutal. Her cat completely lacks a name, and this is something they kept in the movie, thank God. She doesn't want to give him a name because he doesn't have a home. He doesn't belong with her. She doesn't belong with him. They're just two people, two creatures inhabiting the same thing. Mm-hmm. to that nature, our narrator doesn't get a name. He's nicknamed Fred by her because he reminds her of her brother, mm-hmm. but he doesn't ever get a real name. It isn't until they made the movie that he gets a name. Mm-hmm. So no one in this book is expected to have a solid foundation by the end of it. Everybody is constantly in transit.
Yeah, absolutely. And you see that a lot with narratives about people that are on lower societal ranks. One of the things that eventually broke me down about Aaron Mankey was his early episode on Robert the Doll, where he goes on an absolute tear about the Jamaican housekeeper that gave Jean the doll named Robert. It's like, and history tends to not pay attention to your name if you're a woman, especially if your skin isn't white. And it's like, we know, Aaron, we know. Did you find the woman's name, Aaron? Have you put in any more work?
A lot of versions of the story that came from an aunt.
Yeah. So he invented a magical foundation. Yeah. So he invented a magical Negro that he takes out of the episode when it's on Amazon because he invented a magical Negro. So fuck you, Aaron. He's never going to listen to this.
So moving into questions of sexuality, this is a book that definitely does not shy away from it enough that Harper's Bazaar had some issues. Really, it was more on capitalism. We'll get to that later. Holly does not shy away from using the word dyke. She uses it to get out of certain situations as well as get into certain situations. Correct. At one point in time, Meg Wildwood, I believe it is, or another woman is really uncomfortable because she's like, well, I don't know. I think you might try to steal my man or something. And she's like, oh, well, I'm a dyke. And she even says at one point in time, she goes, I'm not much of one, but I am one. Like, she like takes the title when it's convenient for her. Mm-hmm. Her brother is coded as gay. A lot of the references they make and a lot of the references for the narrator. And again, he doesn't come out at any point in time and be like, hi, I'm queer. How are you? It's more little cultural things that are thrown in, certain words that are used, certain behaviors that are added in. And that was 100% intentional from Truman Capote. Again, we think he felt like he was more clever than he really was. But at the time, it wasn't common lingo. Like, it wasn't something that you would just walk up to your people at the country club and be like, ha ha ha, and say something. It was, if you were part of the group, you knew what was going on.
Right. It was an in-group thing. And that's, I see how people feel that way about Truman Capote, that, you know, upon a less examined glance, he does look like a grand revolutionary when, in all honesty, he was a guy.
One thing I do want to get in before we get into Tiffany's, because I saw your notes.
Thank you.
The Doc and Holly age difference is so fucking creepy. Because he's like damn near 40 when she's 14 and comes onto his farm. And he's like, ooh, this works. The thing with that is, I don't think that Truman Capote even thought that that was that weird based on his upbringing. His mom was a very young mother. She spent a lot of time in New York with much older men that had money.
Yeah. I mean, I guess like that's probably why it didn't really flag for me, as I put it in the proverbial, it was a different time box. Like, it's not great. I definitely don't think it was great or good, but yeah, I think I just put that in the, it's a different time box. It's because sometimes you have to.
All right. Do you want to talk about Tiffany's for folks?
We can talk about Tiffany's for folks. So Tiffany's was a jewelry store that opened in 1837. Yes, it is that old. It started in New York. It is expensive as shit. And their jewelry pieces were considered to be some of the highest quality. known to man. Between them and De Beers, they created this market around diamonds because diamonds are actually kind of trash. But De Beers started buying up all the diamonds, so there was false scarcity and jacked up the price on them. Diamonds really should only be used in industrial applications, but De Beers decided that they wanted to sell these worthless carbon rocks. Amanda goes full conspiracy mode. And between really Tiffany's and De Beers, they created what we know as like modern luxurious jewelry. Usually jewelry at that point was handmade, it was passed down, it was heirloom. But Tiffany said, we're going to commodify and make it something. We're going to make it a little piece of luxury that you can always have. Tiffany's became famous for that all through the 1800s and 1900s, and even continues to this day to be associated with nothing but really like high class and luxury. You can, in fact, still get breakfast at Tiffany's. I think it's like $100 per person.
Which... We just did the Holly Golightly thing and ate a bagel in front of the store. We were waiting for a parade.
Yeah. Like, I think it's like, it's expensive to have breakfast at Tiffany's. Fun fact, Tiffany blue is inspired by the fact that Victorian brides were quite fond of turquoise. And used it very, very frequently as bridal adornment and bridal gifts. So that's how Tiffany blue became a thing. And Tiffany's now is owned by a multi-conglomerate of Louis Vuitton, Monet, and Hennessy.
So one of the things that always tripped me the fuck up is I grew up near South Coast Plaza in California. For those of you who know South Coast Plaza, you know what I'm talking about. For those of you who don't, it is a massive mall that takes up quite a bit, and they've expanded over time. I used to work at Barnes & Noble, guys. Anyway, there is a whole section that is just devoted to luxury. It is devoted to Louis Vuitton. There are armed guards. Same thing with Tiffany's. You have this whole section of the mall that feels quiet and reserved and protected. Now, the busy section of the mall is over where Sears and shit used to be. I don't know if Sears is still there. But that's where the regular folk can go. We had people fly in from Japan to shop in the luxury section of this mall, which growing up there, you're just like, this is ridiculous. We just don't go to that portion of the mall. But it was such a big cultural thing. It was always treated with this weird reverence. Our schools couldn't have any kind of security, but the fucking Louis Vuitton had like two armed guards.
Yeah.
I don't know. Which blows my mind because it's a fucking purse or a pair of shoes, guys.
Yeah, I've never understood that kind of stuff, but I think like one of the most expensive things I owned for a while was a Kate Spade smartwatch. But yeah, I don't really see a lot of the utility in expensive things like that. I rather go to an artisan for that sort of stuff.
Well, the second you take it out of the store too, it loses its value. It's kind of like a car.
Right.
And then you have things like where Birkin bags, where people just start fucking collecting them, and you're going, the amount of money that you're spending on this could fucking feed all of South Texas.
Yeah, but I don't know. I think we've reached a point of peak capitalism where the people that do that aren't and never are going to care.
That's true.
Like, I think we probably could have saved the world in the 90s, but I think we've already, we're all too far gone. Yeah.
Because we've come too far.
Yeah, we've already, I think we've already strayed too far from God's light. So that's a little bit about Tiffany's. It is culturally very significant as being one of the big American retailers of luxury. It is probably one of the most synonymous as far as American and luxury, because most of the world considered American goods to be cheap and rugged and not as good as everyone else. But Tiffany's was all about, this is American luxury. This is nice American luxury. And yeah, you absolutely can still get breakfast at Tiffany's. I don't know why you would do that. I just, it blows my mind to think of, like, I'm going to this store or like the Nordstrom's that have like bars and stuff in them. Why do people need these things?
There's so shocking. I know, I just got back from Vegas like a week and a half ago. Vegas is so fucking weird now because it is, you can feel the division, kind of like South Coast Plaza. There are certain areas that you're like, this is definitely designed for families and people who don't have the means. I mean, and we're talking still like, this is expensive for upper middle class households. You're talking $30 a plate at a standard restaurant, which is fucking insane, you guys. But then you turn the corner and there's all these luxury stores, and it's become a very big point where like the Caesars run places have these luxury stores. You have the shops at the Forum. You have that whole area for the Venetian that's like St. Mark's Square kind of thing. It is, I had a moment with my daughter where we were in Austin. Austin is not that fancy, y'all. It's not. They try real hard because we've had a huge influx of people from California. She stood in front of the Gucci store and she said, I can never go in that store. I said, we're going in. And she looked at me and I went, what? I go, pretend you're supposed to be there. No one is supposed to be there. There's no point. This place is ridiculously expensive. I go, you're not going to do anything wrong. You're just going to breathe the air. Come on. And we went in and we walked around and she's like, holy smokes, this is like $500 for this tiny thing. And I'm like, exactly. This is ridiculous. So when I tell you something is ridiculous like this, I need you to understand that I'm not just blowing smoke. Like, nobody needs something that expensive. I don't care who you are. You don't need a $500 coin purse.
But no one who's there is worried about need. That's the whole reason brands like that exist. No one who is there is concerned about need. I think you're judging luxury a little bit too harshly, because that's always going to exist. It's always existed. And Vegas has always been something that has been out of the hands of most Americans. There's a reason why I haven't been going to Vegas frequently and you've been able to. It's always been designed to be like that. So there's always going to be a need for luxury. That has always existed. As soon as someone could grow better plant than you could, that has been established. And inherently, there is nothing wrong with it. It's the inequality that comes from it. And that is not the fault of Gucci inherently. That's the system being broken. No one who's walking into Coach thinks that this is one of their basic human needs. They're there because they want to show off that they can afford a bag of a certain caliber. So wanting luxury and wanting something to ascribe to, that has always been part of the American dream. We have always been told to chase capital as a means to funnel a dying caste and economy. That's just how it is. But there is nothing that is inherently in and of itself wrong with wanting luxury goods. It's the means in which people will take to get it. But do you want to talk about Truman Capote?
Sure. Okay, so this book is very similar to a lot of things in Truman's own life. He was born Truman Persons in New Orleans. His dad was a very petty criminal who was in and out of jail all the time. He had a really traumatic upbringing. His parents divorced when he was 4. His mom's name was Lila May, and she dropped Truman off with his relatives in Monroeville, Alabama, and then she would just kind of peace out and go to New York. She was trying to make a life for herself. When she was there, she went by a completely different personality and name. She went as Nina in New York. She made no qualms about letting people know she never wanted a kid to begin with, and that she'd even tried to abort Truman. That works real great on a kid, guys. Truman learned from this that he needed to adapt to every environment he was in. So he learned to be charming and be part of the party and not be too much of a burden to his relatives. That's something that you kind of see throughout his books and things like that. Nina Lila Mae bounced from man to man, but whenever she ended up being cast out of a particular home in New York, she would come back to Monroeville and she would promise things are going to be different. Things are going to be different. There's a really sad story that is, it's an anecdote that may or may not be true, but because Truman liked to make up details about his life. But there was a story he told about finding a vial of her perfume in the bottom of her purse when she was with a guy and drinking it because he wanted to be close to her. And he didn't know how he was going to get that. He was best friends with Harper Lee as kids because they were both in Monroeville. They lived real close to each other. So there's very similar shared experiences between the two. By the time he was 8 years old, he was already telling people he was a writer. Like, that's my profession. I'm a writer. He ended up going to New York, was working at New York Magazine, and he got fired for pissing off, of all people, Robert Frost. And that was one person you couldn't piss off at your job and stay. He was very open about being gay, which at the time was not considered, like, people, you hid that. You didn't say anything about it. His socialite friends that he hung out with, as I mentioned before, he called them the Swans. One of these was Gloria Vanderbilt of the Jeans Company and mom to Anderson Cooper, as we've already mentioned. Her brownstone is said to be an inspiration for Holly Golightly's brownstone. So he spent a lot of time there. It seemed like a good setting. He ended up becoming mostly well known for his book In Cold Blood, which was published in 1965. It ended up changing nonfiction and true crime publishing. Before, most of the time, the books were written like penny dreadfuls and they were meant to be read really quickly and thrown away. And he instead did this very detailed personal look at the killers of this this murder in Kansas. He had major depression from years of being scrutinized for not only his homosexuality, but the fact that he liked to lie and change his personality from group to group. Mm-hmm. He died at the age of 59 at Johnny Carson's ex-wife's house. He had liver failure from years of alcoholism and opiate use that he was using to deal with depression, to self-medicate. Mm-hmm. For Breakfast at Tiffany's itself, initially Harper's Bazaar offered to publish it for $2,000. They didn't want to publish it as written. They had a lot of issues about the language. For example, he said hell a lot in it, damn, dyke. And they're like, we need to change that. The reason they wanted to change it was because Harper's biggest advertiser at the time was Tiffany's Jewelry Company. So they were worried that if they put the story in that was very spicy, that involved the Tiffany's name, that Tiffany would dump them. So they went back and forth. Truman said, I don't want to change it. They said, we want you to change it. He was off in Europe, and Esquire wired him and said, hey, we bought your story from Harper's Bazaar for $3,000. We're giving you an extra $1,000 for this. And they published it with all the original language. It was published in the November 1948 edition. What was interesting is Esquire was actually a man's magazine. It was marketed as that. That's what it was seen as. But women went in droves to buy the magazine for the first time ever. And so it was a huge marketing gimmick, and they made a lot of money off it. As stated, the movie is definitely an adaptation. They keep a lot of the things, but because of the way movies had to be written and filmed at the time, you had to take a lot of stuff out. So you don't hear Audrey Hepburn ever say the word dyke, from what I can remember. She's very, very particular about how she is held in that movie. She claimed it was one of her more challenging roles because she was very much an introvert. And Holly Golightly is very extroverted. They had to tone down a lot of the language in the movie itself. For example, a hint at her being a call girl. They didn't want to flat out call her a call girl in the movie because it was Audrey Hepburn and she was sacrosanct. The line was changed from I got $50 for the ladies' room, which was like an implication of I went and had sex with this guy, too. He gave me $50 for the powder room to make it more innocent. Capote himself was not involved with the film. There are rumors that he hated the casting, that he hated the way it came out, but there's no like official proof of that. He took his $65,000 check that he got for the rights to the movie, went to Europe with his partner, Jack, and spent a shit ton of time writing in cold blood. He wrote a letter back to, or a telegram back to the state saying, you know, go on with the movie, have fun, do what you need to do. I'm going to be in Europe until I finish this book, which was a lie because it took him 6 years to write it. So he did not spend all that time in Europe. So I did throw stuff in about the movie. There's an incredible book called, I think it's 5 a.m. New York Breakfast at Tiffany's or something like that. It's supposed to be like about converting it from the book to the movie.
Right.
No one had any idea how the hell they were going to adapt this at the time, because Holly Golightly was not seen as a role model. It wasn't something that you normally had on screen. Usually if you had prostitutes or anything like that, sex workers of any kind, they usually died by the end of the movie. They used to cast Anna May Wong as Chinese prostitutes quite a bit just so they could be like, oh, look, she's doing all these things. We can kill her at the end of the film. That was really common for buxom beautiful women. They didn't want to give them solid roles. They gave them things where they would kill them. So this was one of the first times that we had a very uncommon role on screen where somebody gets to have a decent ending, which is weird because the book does not have a happy ending. No, we don't know what happens to Holly at the end of the book. They have speculations. Her friends are all like, what the fuck? We don't know what happened to her. This was considered to be such a different role from what Audrey Hepburn had been playing, which was princesses and innocent girls and young women who marry and that kind of thing, that Paramount kept drafting these PR notices over and over and over, going, she's not playing to type. She's not a sex worker. She's a cafe society weirdo. Sorry. Mm-hmm. It was a real big deal. So yeah. The other big reference we get to this is the song by Deep Blue, something that was really popular in the 90s, but it ended up not being like, it's about the movie. It's not about the book, guys.
And I never want to hear it again.
It was really common at karaoke for a while.
It was so overplayed. Oh my God. What were the 90s? What were any of us doing back then?
Well, I was a child, so.
I was also a child. We have some resources available for you, including the crab lamp.
Oh, hell, the crab lamp.
And some really, really interesting ones about Truman Capote. I knew a fair amount about Truman Capote. There was, of course, that one autobiographical movie that everyone says is amazing. And yeah, he was
Capote or
Capote. Yes.
Cause there were two that came out about roughly the same time that, and I think it was Infamous. One had,
I think I'm thinking of Infamous. It's the one with Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Philip Seymour Hoffman is, Capote.
Okay. Whatever. The one about Truman Capote. But yeah, there's, he was never super high on my reading list when I was younger. Shockingly, jumping the gun, I never had to read this as a child.
I didn't have to read this. I had myself read in cold blood because I was interested in it in college, not high school. Definitely not elementary school.
I have never had to read this before. You know what? It's fine. It's fine.
I enjoyed it a lot more than I thought I would, but I cheated. I listened to the Michael C. Hall adaptation from Audible because it was free at the time. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay, I'll try that. Cause I was like, okay, you know what? I've got a credit. I'll just use it. This is not an advertisement for Audible, but if you want to support us, let us know. But I ended up listening to it in like, it's not a very long book. So I think the whole thing is like 4 hours, but I sped through it. Mm-hmm. But Michael C. Hall is a delight.
Yeah. I mean, it was, at least it was breezy. At least it was breezy. All right. Next month is my birth month, and I have no idea what we're doing because both hosts have had some stuff going on in their personal lives, but we will let you guys know as soon as we decide whether we're taking a break or if we are doing a book, what book we're doing. Let us know in ye olde comments if there is a book that you would particularly like us to see or read. Keep in mind, it is my birth month, and I always get the final say because I will likely make bad decisions.
So we are all over social media, so if you do want to comment, you can find us at Unfortunately Required Reading on Facebook, Unfortunately RR on Twitter, Unfortunately Required on Instagram, or unfortunatelyrequiredreading.com, or if you just want to send an email, unfortunatelyrequiredreading@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm. If you would like to support the show and keep the lights on, you may do so at whatever link Spotify changes to /support. I think it's still podcast.spotify/unfortunatelyrequiredreading/support. Your funds greatly help us continue to keep the show going as we work through our own miniature adpocalypse, and they'd be greatly appreciated. We would like to thank this time our patrons as they help continue to fuel the show as it is. We will never reach Alex Jones levels where we are begging at the end of every episode aggressively, but certainly we are very, very much noticing that ads are currently not helping us pay the bills the way we'd like. So if you'd like to support the show, you can do so that way or buy us some merch, which is available at Redbubble. And yeah, thank you guys so much for listening. It was fun.
Go read a book.
Go read a book. Bye.